This is Liz Brewer, the author of The Ultimate Guide to Party Planning and Etiquette, and you're listening to Alex Levchuk and the Midweek Drivettes on Saran 107.3 FM and southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com.
Kurt Smith and Roland Azabal. Tears for Fears. And Suffer the Children. Thanks to the Siren News team. Cracking results as ever. This is the Midweek Drive and a recording of the Midweek Drive, a pre-record that was put together just a wee while ago, because I'll be heading off to London. I'll actually be in London now, together with the rest of the Midweek Drivette team. Ed Wellman, Katie Grimerson, possibly even Holly Cox will be currently just about the LWT Centre for ITV in London. There we are, bit of information there. You might like to check up on the whole thing. And why not, indeed? It's for the Royal Television Society's debate on ageism in the media. Just a little heads up, we should be back for tomorrow morning, of course, the Midweek Drive morning edition, where Ed Wellman and Katie Grimerson will be back with us, together with, hopefully, Fatini Efstathiou, and we'll be featuring Minty Steed once again, talking about her rural adventures. Richard Fitzwilliams will be talking about the latest Hunger Games movie. Ian Lennox will be back with more Tyneside Thoughts, and we'll be welcoming Bill Coles, a tabloid journalist of over 25 years, who's recently just produced a book called Red Top. And he's going to be chatting about his time with the Express, with the Mail, and the whole heap of other factors as well, making his debut on the show tomorrow morning, around about 9 a.m. actually, although the show starts as ever at 8 a.m. on a Thursday. William Sitwell will be joining us as well, and hopefully Alan Stevens will be talking about his latest Caldor City adventures with, of course, Radio B. I won't say any further at this particular stage, but what the hey. It's time now on Siren 107.3 FM for the Midweek Drive to actually press a very famous button in many ways. It is indeed the Michelle Monroe button.
Today I've selected a folk rock song, originally written and released by Fred Neil in 1966. The song was destined for Neil's second album, 1966 self-titled Fred Neil. It was composed towards the end of the session, after Neil had become anxious to wrap the album so he could return to his home in Miami, Florida. Manager Herb Cohen promised that if Neil wrote and recorded a final track, he could go. Tonight's choice, recorded in just one take, was the result. A version of the song performed by Harry Nilsson became a global success in 1969, reaching number 2 and number 6 on the Billboard Adult Contemporary Chart and Pop Singles Chart, respectively, and winning a Grammy after it was featured on the soundtrack of the film Midnight Cowboy. The song, which described the singer's desire to retreat from other people to the ocean, is among the most famous works of both artists and has been covered by many other notable performers. The song later appeared in the 1994 film Forrest Gump and is also on the film's soundtrack album. It also appeared on the comedy film soundtrack for Borat and The Hangover 3. Dad's version took two takes and was recorded at Abbey Road Studios on the 2nd of March 1970. The three-hour session, arranged and conducted by Kenny Clayton and produced by George Martin, was diarised to record three songs for Dad's forthcoming album release, We're Gonna Change the World. The media eagerly anticipated the release, as did his fans. In fact, everybody's talking.
Siren 107.3 FM, and it's the Midweek Drive with Alex Levchuk really looking after the whole sort of sequence to us at the same time, probably now, actually, just about to present something actually in the joys of the South Bank in London, all about ageism in the media. Anyway, moving on from that, one of the legends of Lincoln Inspired, who's also with us and doing a whole variety of aspects, etc., because he is, when it comes to the East Midlands, the go-to guru when it comes to matter science fiction, is ace publisher extraordinaire, and indeed Lincoln Inspired patron, John Jarrell. Hello, John. How are you keeping?
Hi, Alex.
We haven't really spoken about the excitement of the World Fantasy Convention, because this was, I know when we last did a Lincoln-inspired Thursday takeover, and there was this big sort of event that was taking place in Brighton, of course. So how did it go?
It was wonderful. There was about 1,000 people there. It usually takes place in the US, so we get it about once a decade, and it was wonderful.
Which is all great stuff. And more than that, of course, we've already talked about Chris Beckett, who won the Arthur C. Clarke Award earlier this year. But it looks, in terms of the World Fantasy Convention as well, more good news as far as awards for your clients are concerned as well.
Absolutely. With the agency, we've got, I think, 53 books being published this year, and all science fiction, fantasy and horror. And two of my clients, Adam Neville and John Gwynne, won awards. Adam won the Best Horror Novel of the Year, the British Fantasy Awards. For Last Days, which is published by Pan, and John won the Best Debut Fantasy of the Year for Malice.
Yes, named after, of course, the late, great David Gemmell, of course, the David Gemmell Morning Star Award. So, again, it's interesting.
Who I used to publish many years ago.
Really?
Yeah, used to be the science fiction and fantasy publisher at Random House in the mid-90s, and David and I both lived in Hastings, so we got together fairly regularly as well as working together.
Which is fantastic. Now, we started off by saying, obviously, I'm hosting this debate with Nick Ross and others about ageism in the media. And does that still occur within publishing, John? I mean, hopefully not. I mean, do you get to the stage where you think, right, so how chronologically gifted are you? Oh, sorry, your best work's behind you. Off you go, love.
It's completely subjective. Mm. In terms of authors, I've just taken on a 21-year-old, but one of my other authors is in his 60s, and I didn't take either of them on or think about refusing them because of their age. Mm. It's about the prose. Because, to be honest, somebody walking into Smith's or Waterstones on a wet Wednesday morning to read something on the train is not going to think, ooh, is this person 60 or is this person 21? Mm. They're going to think about the book, whether their friends have said it's wonderful. That's what matters. It's the prose.
It's almost the plot of a science fiction novel itself in many ways, this whole notion of you reach a... I'm thinking Logan's Run, obviously, William F. Nolan.
Over 30 and you're dead.
Well, absolutely.
I'm glad I'm not.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I think the flip side, in the remake that we're talking about, they were going to make it over 21, so that's interesting.
Yeah, it's coming down. I'm getting a bit worried about that.
Yeah, well, it's not the mileage, it's whatever. Novellas. We've spoken about that quite frequently on the Midweek Drive, and also with Phil Leonis over in Los Angeles with the Chill Pack Hollywood scenario. And the novella was a format which, even arguably, you could say something like Jekyll and Hyde to a certain extent was within that whole field. A lot of greats. The Time Machine itself with H.G. Wells, kind of a relatively dense, packed information. Is the novella kind of making a little bit of a resurgence? I mean, is there still a place? Because we've talked about short stories and how is that wonderful art form. They're fantastic.
Yeah.
But what about that kind of midway house between the short story and the fully fledged novel?
Well, really, you're looking either at small presses or at e-publication. Mm. In terms of the general market, what the readership wants is a big fat book. And the last time, as a publisher, I published a science fiction novel less than 100,000 words long was 1990. Mm. So all of these things change. For instance, two of my favourite science fiction novels published in the 50s are by Alfred Bester, Tiger, Tiger and the Demolished Man. Mm. If they came in now, you'd be saying, Alfie, got to be twice as long.
Yeah.
So those things do change. And today, those books might be looked at as novellas rather than novels.
Yeah.
But there is a market. It's just not a mainstream paperback market.
That's quite interesting, though. Obviously, people want that substantive feel of the glossy text and the sort of this is a serious thing. Presumably for the hardback market as well. I mean, is it fair to say? I mean, is there a kind of split between hardbacks and paperbacks and so on? I mean, obviously, hardbacks are usually slightly more expensive than paperbacks, unless they go straight into the remainder sort of bin. Is that something you look at as well in terms of the business operations?
Well, when you talk to a publisher, I'm aware, having been a publisher myself 15 years before I started the agency, that you look at each project individually. So in some cases you will say, I think this should be a paperback original, and you'll discuss that with your sales and marketing team. And in some cases you will say, I think we should do a proper hardback of this, or a large format paperback, and then go into mass market. So it's very much horses for courses. And again, there are no absolutes in publishing. There are no straightforward templates. You look at each book, each project separately. And of course you're looking at series with science fiction and fantasy rather than one-offs most of the time. Not always, but most of the time.
Let's talk about some of the other good success news that actually comes through. I'm looking at the website johnjarrell.co.uk, and I'm seeing, obviously, an Italian rights deal that's also cropped up from that. The international markets, this is for Mark Sharon Newton.
That's right.
Is that a sort of growing... I mean, obviously, it's almost a no-brainer as a question, but in terms of the international market, do you sort of have one eye always on cultural elements of the kind of product that your clients are actually producing?
Absolutely not. It has to be the book it is. Mm. You never tailor a book, neither for the UK nor the US nor anywhere else. The book is the book. And if you start looking in those terms, you actually stop from concentrating on writing the wonderful book. And anything that does that to you is wrong, because you should love your writing as a novelist. And if you don't, it'll just sit there on the page smelling like a week-old fish. Basically, so it's very much about the book it should be. International market's important, of course it is, but it's still subjective. So I just did a deal with Gollancz for a debut novelist, did a three-book deal, but 10 other publishers turned it down. So it's always going to be that subjectivity.
Mm. Interesting, and I think actually sort of very wise words, as we'd expect. The other sort of line of things is I've noticed over the years, and it's interesting when you sort of read through novels and writers from that perspective, there does seem to be a more cinematic edge coming to people's writing. Now, this may well be because simply overexposure to the whole sequence, that we do have a whole generation of writers who would not have known life before the television set, for instance, and the sort of the cinema impact from there. Do you sometimes sort of sense, oh, right, this is almost half kind of classic prose novel and half projected screenplay?
I think with science fiction and fantasy, where you're building the world as well as telling the story, that will happen in the author's mind, because they have to have that world completely set. I used to publish Robert Jordan. I published his first three best-selling fantasy novels at Orbit. And he told me he'd spent a year building the world before he wrote the first word of the first book. So the author in this area is as deeply entrenched in their world as they are in the story. So that cinematic sense will always come through.
Fascinating in terms of crime fiction to actually hear that you've recently got a featured client, Justine Hopkins, of course.
Yep.
Daughter indeed of Zedcar's creator, yep, John Hopkins.
And a wonderful writer.
Yeah, the whole sort of notion of that, and I suppose Troy Kennedy Martin's work as well in the field connects together. In terms of that, is that another sort of case where you think you're sort of seeing a sort of genetic notion? Because obviously in the business of show, sometimes you get offspring of famous actors and so on, and sometimes they actually come up with the goods, and other times you think, well, they're not quite what their dad or their mum was, basically. No names, obviously. In terms of writing, is that something where you can almost rub your hands with glee, where you think, well, you know, John Hopkins, good pedigree, let's see how the daughter's like?
Only if the words work. If the words work, and it's wonderful, as Justine is a brilliant storyteller, then it's another thing you can say to the publisher. It's another hook that, if they're interested, their sales department can use when they present the book to the book trade, and another hook that their marketing department can use when they tell everybody about the book. So what you're looking for is as many different hooks as you can use, and that is one. But it doesn't make you take an author on. The only thing that makes you take the author on is the words on the page.
We were recently talking to Jamie Anderson, the son of the late, great, and much lamented Gerry Anderson, of course. Jamie, who recently funded one of his father's late projects as a book via crowdfunding. Is that another sort of growth area? Clearly, Lincoln Inspired could not exist without crowdfunding and so on. Do you think that we're also seeing authors also maybe thinking, well, this is a way forward to kind of partly self-publish, but also publish by people who actually appreciate the setup as well?
I chat to authors outside my agency on a regular basis. I mean, I've been doing SF conventions for 40 years, and so I know a lot of authors over the years. And some of them are starting to say to me, with projects that are not necessarily their main novel projects, but something else that might be illustrated, they're looking at crowdfunder. So I think it's one of the great things about the last 15, 20 years is that it's a much broader area than it used to be. You can go to small presses, you can self-publish, you can look at crowdfunder. All of these things are available now. It's a very exciting time.
Mm. Still to come on the show this evening, we'll be speaking hopefully to Graham Harper, our BAFTA award-winning director of Doctor Who, and others, of course. It's a bit of a tragedy. He still hasn't actually sort of got back into the Doctor Who fold, although obviously his work with Coronation Street and indeed Holby City Casualty, of course, is taking precedence as well. But as Who, obviously, tomorrow we actually see the official launch of the William Hartnell An Earthly Child, the docudrama of the early days of Doctor Who, and we approach the 50th anniversary. Would you describe yourself as a mainstream Whovian, a kind of mildly interested Whovian, or somebody who actually turns around and says, well, I didn't think that was going to last 50 years?
I am sadly old enough to remember watching the first episode on November the 23rd, 1963, when I was 10.
Yeah.
And I love Doctor Who. Of course, I think there are some things about it that are better than others, but I've been very impressed with the way it's been brought back. Mm. And I think it's something that is wonderful. And again, you can't say that something will last 50 years or won't last 50 years. Most don't, obviously. But it's fabulous. It can rebuild itself. It can re-energize itself on a regular basis. That brilliant idea of regeneration.
And it's intriguing, of course, that we're also hearing that there's a high, strong, or in fact, a fairly strong possibility that Quatermass is going to be re-engaged, certainly as one of the precursors, as far as Nigel Neal was concerned, with respect to Doctor Who, and, of course, that whole Sidney Newman, Verity Lambert era.
Absolutely.
John, it's been fantastic as ever having this encyclopedic range from the state of the publishing industry through to congratulations to the World Fantasy Comic, various other things. There's another major event that's happening next year, I believe, in terms of science fiction in the country. Is that right?
Yes, the World Science Fiction Convention, which, again, we get roughly once a decade. Mm. It's usually in the US.
Yep.
Will be in London in August 2014. If anybody wants to look at it, they can Google World SF Convention 2014. And the last time it was in London was 1965. We've had it four times since, but not in London.
Yeah.
So that's wonderful. And I'm looking forward to that hugely. Lots of international authors, lots of international publishers. There will probably be 5,000 people there.
I certainly sense we should definitely be looking at a location report there for the Midweek Drive team and Siren FM, or doing some sort of live features. Lord knows we do the annual Sci-Fi London Film Festival's Louis Savvy, which is growing tremendously well and doing good stuff. So we must look towards that as well. John, the usual two final questions. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link? I think it's the first time we've just had a one-on-one, if memory serves.
I thoroughly enjoyed myself.
Good. So can we look forward to hopefully connecting with you again in the very near future?
Whenever it suits you, sir.
Siren FM and South Side Broadcasting actually collectively share the joy of knowing that the wonderful world and the magic that is the Grumbleweed still continues in its own magical way, and we're delighted almost beyond measure to be able to speak to the fabulous Robin Colville now. Robin, how are you?
I can't follow that introduction up. That's brilliant. Thank you.
It's short, but it's to the point, and it's critical because clearly you're taking part in a really important event at the Darlington Civic Theatre on, indeed, Wednesday, the 20th of November. It's a tribute to Graham, of course. A tribute to Graham.
I mean, all the funds are going to, obviously, cancer research, and not just research, but to people who suffered cancer, and Macmillan, various cancer things. It's all to do with that, but it's in his memory. And everybody in the business, we've done one in Nottingham, and so many of the acts that we know so well and have been grown up with us have said, oh, we want to do it, we want to do that show, but we can't, we're away. So we said, well, we'll do two, and we did one in Nottingham, and we're doing the one in Darlington. So one down south, one up north, and it was a 3.5 hour show. And although the acts did it for nothing, they were coming out saying, I would have paid to be on that show. It was the best variety show I've ever been involved with. And the audience were coming out saying, never had a night like that. That's just going to be the funniest variety show I've ever seen. So, well, we did plan it that way. And we all had a lot of fun because we all know each other. So this one, we know because we love Darlington. And we've all got, the people who are on it have got what's an affinity with Darlington anyway. I mean, the Crankies, Linda Lassardi's husband, Sam Kane, Chico, that's why I met him. So we all love Darlington, so we're really looking forward to doing it. Be a very funny night.
I think all you have to say is, effectively, it's Grumbleweed time, not Chico time. That's critical, you know. That's sort of system.
Well, actually, Chico said, can I do some comedy with you? I said, I'd love you to, yeah. Because he says, can I do that thing that you used to do with Graham? I said, yeah, of course you can. It's been my pleasure. And the ending, I won't tell you the ending, but the ending bit that we did nothing, very poignant. Not a dry eye in the house. It's amazing. Just a wonderful ending tribute to Graham. It's fantastic.
You mentioned the Crankies. Of course, we work regularly with one of the people who used to write the music for the Crankies. That's Peter Kerr, who is a Scottish author. Brian Connolly, of course, is with us. And, of course, the fantastic ostrich man himself, Bernie Clifton, is there.
If he can get off the plane in time, he said he's coming from, I think he's on a cruise and he's flying back, so hopefully he's going to be there. Yeah, and we've got Zuka Magic, who are quite amazing. If you've never seen them, they're unbelievable. And a couple of surprises. We've got the Laurel and Hardy, and just a fun night. It really is a fun night.
You mentioned something really important there, Robin, which was the V word, variety. And that's something which, I mean, we were speaking to Ken Dodd a few weeks ago, and he was obviously a fantastic trooper, much like yourself in many ways from that point of view. And there is the sort of notion that somehow perhaps we forget just how much good, wonderful variety entertainment can actually bring to the world and actually sort of really provide an uplifting night out.
Yeah. Well, when people say to me, do you watch The X Factor or Britain's Got Talent? I say, well, yeah, I watch Britain's Got Talent because it's a variety show. Mm-hmm. That's why it's successful. Mm-hmm. It's a variety show. I mean, okay, some of the weird comedians are going out and comedy is the new rock and roll and they're filling stadiums. And I mean, I think I'm old school. I don't really understand a lot of what they do. Some of them are very clever and very talented. I don't understand a lot of it. And a lot of people of my age and the audiences we appeal to say, I don't understand it. I don't get it. I said, well, no, maybe we're just a different era. So we are old school, I suppose, when it comes to that sort of variety. But the variety's still there on the Britain's Got Talent. They're still coming out with these weird things and you think, oh, isn't that clever? Isn't that funny?
It probably seems like only yesterday, 1962, was there. You were launching the whole sequence. I can't believe that, you know, over 50 years in the business. Do you kind of get a sense of cyclical things? I mean, you mentioned that obviously the Britain's Got Talent. I still think Huey Green and Opportunity Knox was probably the sort of the pace setter for that, really.
Well, we were on Opportunity Knox.
Absolutely.
We did come last, I hasten to add. We were beaten by an army display team, but... And that's the truth. But for some unknown reason, we used to do the clubs, and he would say, "Bill, we were builders, all-time winners. We never won once, but it set us on the career." Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's a bit strange working without Graham, I do have to say. Well, I mean, I'm doing Panto with him this year in Crewe, and it's going to be very strange. I've done a couple of shows solo. I do miss him, bless him. I mean, I was with him 51 years,
I mean, there are also those of us who certainly remember the classic Grumbleweeds radio show, set a whole new standard for radio entertainment. You can take your Tommy Handley and Itmar and say, no, it's all come back to the joys of the Grumbleweeds. I mean, any thoughts of kind of returning to the medium of radio? I mean, obviously we're doing a radio interview now, but I'm just sort of thinking the radio needs you. It needs you, Robin.
I absolutely love radio more than television. The thing about radio, Ken Dodd will say the same. Anybody of my era will say the same, because it's in your mind. If you could say, well, here we are on this spaceship, you've already got a picture in your mind of the spaceship, and you can, it's your own mind that makes it, as opposed to, oh, that's a rubbishy set, isn't it? No, the sets are what you make them, and you can be anywhere in the world. I think that's why the radio, we did things like Star Trek, Nobbert Just, you know, it was a Yorkshire Star Trek, and Mr. Spock and talking like that, you know. And you made your own pictures in your mind, which was a bizarre thing.
And certainly running from 1979 to 1988, it's little wonder you actually won the Best Radio Show Award from the Television and Radio Industries Awards in 1983. So it's good to see that obviously quality was recognised there. Sometimes, though, I must admit, Robin, it's always confusing the two there. It would have been a miracle indeed if Greg could have actually just come into that conversation. But sometimes, Robin, I'm often thinking that, you know, is radio lacking something now in terms of innovation, etc.? Because you listen to some material, you think that's very dry and uninteresting.
Well, it does for me. It does for me. But there again, I'm not in the echelons of where they sit and decide what they're going to put on. I mean, they looked at us and said, we don't think the Grumbleweeds are the right image for BBC Two, so we're dropping the show. Mm-hmm. It was when the guy came to see the show and he came in sandals with a long beard, and I said to Graham, I said, that's us for the off. And I was right. You know, he was just a different person that was running it. Yeah. And it's up to him. They don't look at the... I mean, when we were getting all the awards and we were getting 11 million listeners on Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock, people used to make the Sunday lunch and then put the Grumbleweeds radio show on, which was brilliant. And then for some unknown reason, they moved it to 10 o'clock at night on a Saturday. And of course, it went down a few million. Oh, it's not getting as many listeners. No. Yeah. I wonder why.
And I think even earlier, I have fond memories of the Sunday afternoon Navy Lark and the Clitheroe Kid and various other things. There was a kind of traditional slot there, really, for comedy.
I love those. I listen to Radio 4 Extra, and I listen to the Clitheroe Kid. I listen to the Navy Lark. I listen to Dad's Army. They're all on the radio. Steptoe and Son. They're brilliant. Absolutely love them. Most people do.
And indeed, as I say, of course, the notion of the good self and the Grumbleweeds, well up there in terms of quality.
Yeah, well, I sometimes people do ring me up and say, you're on Radio 4. I might want to turn it on. And some of the programmes, we did that many. I can't remember how many we did, about 160 or something like that. And I don't even remember doing some of them. They said, oh, did that voice? You know, I don't even remember the character. I think it was me, that voice. I don't remember. I mean, to have a guy living there with a gas mask on all the time was just bizarre.
It's
and two gay guys living in a house and a tramp and Uncle Rubbish and Uncle... Hello, kiddies. Uncle Rubbish here.
It's not for nothing that it was the number one and is still the number one comedy act in the world. Robert, it's been a fabulous sort of blast just sharing some thoughts with you. A reminder, of course, that in terms of the event, and let's face it, it is the event, it's at the Darlington Civic Theatre Wednesday, the 20th of November.
Next Wednesday, yeah.
I know, absolutely. In fact,
Come if you don't like laughing, seriously, because it is seriously funny.
Precisely so. It is an absolute must from that point of view. Thanks to Mike Ryle, of course, from the Showbiz Charity organisation for obviously helping put us together. We've got two final questions for you. These are like critical ones though, Robin, so we'll just sort of breathe and work our way through this. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today? Has it been okay for you?
It's been a brilliant one.
Okay, so the next critical question is, can we look forward to, after the show, possibly featuring you again on a semi-regular basis, both on Siren FM and some of our other services as well?
Of course you can.
Hey, Robin Colville. I was going to say Robbie Williams there. I didn't know. It's
Ring
been one of those days.
stick some voices on and do your few links. Well, hello, my name's Julian. Welcome to the show. And all that sort of stuff. So, you know, it's amazing. You don't get this in Scotland.
I think, Robin, you've already you've booked yourself in for the next 2 decades. So they were sorted on that one. Robin Colville, we'll salute you. Many thanks indeed.
God bless you. See you on Wednesday.
From LA to Lincoln and via sirenonline.co.uk to the world, it's time for the midweek drive to connect with investigative filmmaker and planetary truth seeker, the one, the only, Phil Leoners.
Quite right, too. Okay, as we said, and we made quite clear during the course of the programme, because we believe, as Graham Harper quite rightly said, in keeping it real and not trying to pretend that we're live when we're not live, etc. But we do thank, certainly so far, Cameron Tilbury for an expanded, delightful range of country music joys from Nashville. Thanks obviously to our BAFTA award-winning director Graham Harper, from the pre-production planning officers of the series Holby City, with his own views on Doctor Who and more. Thanks to Michelle Munro, who I've said it before, third time on the show, Matt Munro providing you with a version of Harry Nilsson's Everybody's Talking. Amazing. And of course, thanks to John Gerald for his news about the World Science Fiction Conference, which of course lands in Britain, the convention, for the first time actually this century. Next year we'll be looking ahead to that. Plus of course our fame man from the Grumbleweeds, that would be Robin Colville. But yes, certain shows, essential tent poles effectively, are there and needs to be writ large. And to actually, even on a show where the midweek drive team with yours truly Alex Levchuk and Ed Wellman and Katie Grimmison, possibly even Holly Cox, we're currently in London, probably about to go on stage as this is actually going out to the good citizens of Lincoln and online through sirenonline.co.uk. As you've heard Phil Leoners, it's essential that you're there. How are you, Phil?
I am so relieved that we don't have to pretend that this is live.
No,
as you know from listening to my weekly podcast, Chilpack Hollywood Hour, I do not do a good job of maintaining the fiction on those weeks when we have pre-recorded a show.
Precisely.
I always let it slip, so it is a weight off my mind. In fact, once I earned my co-host's ire one episode when I began by using Captain Kirk's speech from that that one episode where he was presumed dead. And I led the show by saying to my audience, by the time you hear this,
yes,
I will be dead, and you will be making the most difficult decisions of your life.
The Tholian
Web. And the Tholian Web, very nicely played. I can't put anything past you, even when you are in a strange studio.
Well, you know, I like to think of it in many ways, actually. For a bit of a description thing, we're recording this from what was Siren FM's paternal studio, because it's up in the northeast, and it's Southside Broadcasting, where we still put the shows out, obviously, on southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com. But yes, as is often the case, you know, it's just a case of press this button here, adjust that one there. It's all good. It's all good. We're here to
so
talk...
You have returned to the ancestral past.
I have.
Very exciting. One must always do that every so often. Return to one's roots, I think.
I think it's certainly which it helps. It keeps it, as I say, constant with the universe and identifies on that. And I just realised I'm going to have to read out a Mike Dooley thought. I'll put something in, I'm sure, before the end of the production. Moving on. The cast of The Lady Killers, because we've been talking about this off and on for a year or so now, and we've teased the listener by saying, well, you can support it, you can still support it, you can go to The Lady Killers movie.com. You can find out about the cast, including the fabulous Peter Shinkoda, the even more fabulous Lily Holloman, Dean Haglund, also fabulous, of course, Jamie Kayler, Alexandra Burrito. Principal photography is obviously wrapped and so on. And I was looking at the sort of challenge things that we've actually got in terms of where we're going for Audacity and so on. Let's not forget, of course, Catherine Annette, Whitney Anderson, Bert Bulos, of course, who has indeed sat in for your good self, and Heidi Marie Wanser.
Well, she goes by the name professionally Heidi Marie, so let's just call her Heidi Marie. And let's not forget, for my money, possibly the greatest character actor working today. He's, in fact, been described in one LA Times review.
Would that be Tucker Smallwood?
Well, Tucker Smallwood, of course, is dear to me, but I was thinking of Ari Gross,
who was actually
once referred in a review by the Los Angeles Times as the best actor working today, and he's been in everything that's ever been made over the last 25 years, and instantly recognizable to people, though I once asked him in an interview, I asked Ari what he's most likely to be recognized from. And he said, you know, it is odd because he's one of those actors where people are sure they recognize him, but they're not sure what from. And because he's played so many troubled people in so many high-profile projects, they often think that they've seen him in news alerts about someone they should be on the lookout for.
Yeah, well, he, of course, portrays the role of a villainous investment banker in The Lady Killers. And the trailer itself is interesting. Obviously, it's hard-hitting, as you'd expect. I like the little red-eye flash that you've obviously got, a little acknowledgement to the Glenn Larson series Knight Rider right at the end there, possibly unintentional, but I thought, oh, have they got Knight Rider in the whole thing? And it certainly works in an interesting scenario. I mean, share the plot line with us, Phil, because, you know, without giving any spoilers or twists away, this is nothing to do with the Alec Guinness or indeed Tom Hanks movies of the same name. It's The Lady Killers.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons that we put that little teaser trailer together. It is not the official trailer. It was just some footage of the film that I put together from the first 8 days of shooting. We still had 16 more days of shooting to go. So it's a very unpolished little teaser, but I think that it served its purpose to let people know that the tone and the plot of the film that we were making could not be more different than those illustrious predecessors under a similar title, because, again, as we've been so fond of pointing out, it's The Lady Killers, but it is not the same title as those earlier, the Lady Killers, because we have a full space between the word lady and killers, and we will let the audience ponder the meaning of that space themselves. But the basic plot of our enterprise is that seven men in their 40s, bored with their lives, ready to blow things up, decide to revive a very immature game from their past, a game of romantic conquest, where the men are awarded points in a variety of categories based on their romantic pursuit and conquest of certain targeted women. And they play the game for high money stakes, and in the process of this game commit many heinous acts and even several felonies. And the game is played, a winner is declared, and then one by one, all the players start turning up dead.
The most unobtainable is one of the categories that's actually used in terms of how you actually select your supposed victim, quote-unquote, for that.
The quality of the person is how they describe it. It's a gentleman's game. That's the obvious. That's how I described it. It's the quality of the woman as determined by how beautiful she is, of course, but really by how unattainable she is, and many factors go into that. My favorite of the four categories of points that is awarded is the proof category, the quality of the proof you share to support your story. However, as the gamekeeper says, it is a gentleman's game. So even if the quality of proof is low, the gentleman is still to be taken at his word, so his points in the other categories should in no way be affected for not offering quality proof.
And just in case fans of Stephanie Erb and Yi Tian and Rick Mora were saying, you haven't mentioned them on the cast as well, we just have. And I'm fascinated by the fact that Rick Mora is playing Detective Valens. Now, does this mean midway through the show you have this notion, Phil, of somewhere during the narrative you'll have him break into a version of A-ra-ra-ra-ra-ra-bamba? Oh, perhaps not.
That is interesting because for some reason I did come across the fact in my voluminous reading on all manner of topics.
Mm-hmm.
I came across the fact that Richie Valens,
yes,
the song you so
exactly
ably
thank
brought
you
to mind, mm-hmm, he is of Native, or was of, Native American ancestry.
Yes.
I had always thought, I had never known that, really. And so once I read that, I thought, oh, well, that's a fantastic, then, name with Native heritage, and I'll use that when the time is right. And I'd actually written a screenplay centered around this character of Detective Valens some years earlier, and when it came time to make this film, I thought, well, it would be nice if this could be set in the same universe as this other script that I plan to make someday. So why not cross over one character?
Right.
And for me, that was this character of Detective Valens, played by the very charismatic Rick Mora.
Exactly. Not to be confused with Richie, as we said, but important nevertheless. We're going to find out how you, yes, that's you, can actually, not you, Phil, but you, listener, can actually still support, get involved with the Lady Killers in a matter of moments. But I feel you're doing such a cracking job here, Phil, as ever, you know, this is the case. I'm not asking you to actually provide director's notes, because as we said at the start, that'd be physically impossible. You know, all right, bits of it might be appearing online beforehand, before it's all put together. And who knows, Mr. Computer might have actually sort of had a nervous breakdown now. But your reward in any case is this.
Lincoln Inspired is more than just an arts festival, more than a literary festival, more than a whole set of lifestyle opportunities, and more than what the world has needed for millennia.
To see just how much more Lincoln Inspired can make you, Go to lincolninspired.co.uk and explore the inspiration.
This is Malcolm Tomlinson, actor, horse racing commentator and voiceover artiste, proudly presenting the Midweek Drive's regular 6:30 p.m. correspondent. Whether he's in his PJs or not, the truth is out there. Director extraordinaire, Mr. Phil Leonard.
And, of course, there is a similarity between Lincoln Inspired and The Lady Killers, because both are actually using crowdfunding as a mechanism for, obviously, supporting these great events. And I'm looking, Phil, now at the site of theladykillers.com, and I've gone to help. And it's not help for the reader, it's we need your help. And if done correctly, The Lady Killers will be one of those dark comedies like Heathers, great for Winona Ryder and Christian Slater, and A Clockwork Orange. Also quite interesting for Malcolm McDowell and Adrian Corry, that continues to resonate, disturb and delight audiences for many years after its initial release. There are three ways in which you can help the Lady Killers team accomplish just such a film. What's one of those ways, Phil Leonis?
Well, by listening to Siren FM.
Wow.
And also downloading the podcast. No, is that not what you wanted me to... It sounded like the perfect opportunity to plug the show.
Oh, there you go. Precisely.
Well, no, people can visit theladykillersmovie.com, the website. They can learn more about it, and they can donate. They can actually make monetary donations in exchange for a fantastic menu of perks. Yeah. That are available, you know, rewards for doing so. And also just by spreading the word. And, I mean, that's really every bit as important. And letting other people know about the film. I wanted to say, Alex, if I may, a little bit about my inspiration for the film, because this ties in to the reason that we do reach out for public support in this way. And it comes from my growing very tired as both a violence prevention specialist, but also as a storyteller and as a human being on planet Earth, growing very tired with the way that images of exploitation, images of violence, are used as entertainment, that are in of themselves exploited for financial gain. As a storyteller, I like using stories to try to inspire people to look at things a slightly different way, and I love using comedy to do so. I find that if you find the right tone, then your message really has a chance to land and resonate for maybe even generations to come, as those illustrious dark comedy predecessors you mentioned have done, and as a more recent vintage of dark comedy, In the Company of Men, I'm sure will do. And so I decided to make a film that shows the ways in which exploitation in all its forms always leads to violence. And that's what The Lady Killers is. And although the description of the plot might sound like something that women might think, oh, I'm not sure I want to see this movie, they should trust me when I say that women especially are going to love this movie. But all of these things that I'm describing, trying to take the way Hollywood does business, take the way that Hollywood depicts violence, take the way that Hollywood depicts exploitation, take the way that Hollywood underserves its female audience, and turn all these things on their side, is definitely something that is, I think, only going to be fully realized if you go outside the main of Hollywood financing opportunities. And so we've gone entirely private investment route. We've put our own resources into the film. And, yes, we do rely on support from the public at large for at least a percentage of what we're doing. And thus far, we've been really thrilled by the help we've been getting, and we continue to need help as we go through the post-production process.
You see, I'm also sensing an investment opportunity here insofar as for $1,000, £500 thereabouts, give or take, you can actually reach the level of the art lover, which gives you all of the your name on the silver screen perks, including official Skype calls and links with that. And I'll throw this in as well, Phil, that if people want to actually find out more about and chat to you guys and the movie as well, if they want to be featured and have their voices immortalised on the Midweek Drive at Siren FM, we will throw that level of support in as well as a special little tribute that they can actually have forever. There we are.
Wow.
Yeah, well.
That is very exciting. You know, is that retroactive? Do I get to go to the kind people who have donated more than £500 already and put them on the Midweek Drive? That's exciting.
Put it as another little thing, just as the gift that keeps on giving, to use a cliche. You know, an added bonus they weren't even expecting, but if they're up for it, we're happy to do that. I made that executive decision.
You're actually talking about having them replace me on a show, aren't you?
No.
You know, I was very...
I'm not even going to use the line, they could be succeeded or they could never replace. I'm not even going to go that way. That's non-negotiable. It's certainly that.
Twice in this this conversation, you've actually provided me no end of relief. The first was by saying that I didn't have to pretend that we weren't pre-recording this.
Yeah.
The second was when you said that I didn't have to give directors notes on the show.
Exactly.
Because... it might seem logical that not having been able to hear the show, that I wouldn't be called upon to do so. But I can't lie. There have been times when I've been called upon to give director's notes in other venues in the past.
Absolutely.
And found that for whatever reason I wasn't paying attention
or
hadn't done my homework. So I just winged it and gave director's notes anyway.
Yeah.
And I sure hope that they were... I tend to be a pretty intuitive guy, so I think, you know, that those notes were exactly what they needed to be at that particular time.
Exactly, yes. And I'm particularly sort of looking at the associate producer level, which gives you the art level perks, plus an actual associate producer credit in the film, plus two tickets to a film festival or special event screening of the film, and indeed the après-show after-party scenario at a location most convenient to you. That's November 2014, estimated time of when that's happening.
Yeah, and there are so many fun little, perks at smaller levels that are included in those larger levels. You know, everything from the flyers that show the film's key art to autographed headshots to copies.
Even an old-fashioned snail mail. Unbelievable. It's great.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Remember that you're almost old enough to remember the post.
Precisely.
The mailbox, yeah.
The Royal Mail, who have always this side of the Atlantic, have now become privatised. Anyway, it's all very strange. I'm not going to go political. It's been too wonderful a show. We certainly have to thank Cameron Tilbury, Graham Harper, Michelle Monroe, Robin Colville, John Jarrold, and, of course, Phil Leonis for helping us put this Midweek Drive magic together. As I say, at this moment, it may well be that Ed Wellman, Katie Grimason, possibly Holly Cox and myself will be just about ready to go and start talking about ageism in the media. And I'll be hosting this event at the South Bank, the old headquarters of London Weekend Television.
And how will I be able to then hear that?
This is a really interesting scenario because it's not actually being recorded. We will be getting various clips and things together, but no, the Royal Television Society events, they have it's an interesting debate structure that they have, so we'll sort of work it out. But we can hopefully guarantee that, assuming we are spared, we will certainly be giving a full report back for the last Midweek Drive of November 2013, which we're already beginning to sort of put to...
Here's the invitation I would like to make to you. We always talk about this. But this is a topic, as you know, that is a very important one on both sides of the Atlantic, this idea of ageism in the media. Mm. And it's something that Dean Haglund and I touch on from time to time in our show. Why don't you come on to our show at some point that we arrange following this debate, and you tell us what transpired, and we... we discuss this topic a bit more from all angles.
That makes perfect sense. I'm happy to accept. Honoured by the invitation. So there we are. It's definitely there. Chillpackhollywood.com, of course, is the location. I won't go into Jackalope Radio because I don't think you even know whether you're on Jackalope Radio at this particular stage. Or
you can probably hear shows from a year ago.
Yeah, well, there we go. Okay. So, exactly. So that's right. Plus the rest of the stuff. Phil, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on this Wednesday midweek drive pre-rec special?
It has been an enjoyable half hour here spent sipping my morning coffee with you, Alex.
And by the way, did the changing man actually suit, did it float the boat? I mean, we didn't really talk about the Paul Weller sort of treat there. I put in the Paul Weller sort of system.
I'm glad that you picked that. I mean, that is not necessarily my favorite of Paul Weller. As you know, Paul Weller is certainly my favorite musical artist, going back all the way to his days with the Jam. But The Changing Man underscores one of the main reasons why, which is this is truly an artist in that he never restrains himself in terms of exploring whatever direction he is inspired to do so. He does not listen to voices of commerce or voices of maybe even sometimes reason or maybe even voices of limitation that will tell him as an artist, you know, best not to go in this direction. It doesn't suit you or it doesn't suit public taste. He goes where he is driven to go because of his own need to explore his talents and his, and quite frankly, what it means to be a human being on this planet Earth. And that inspires me no end. So even when I think he's missed the mark, I find, as I do with most artists, I find his failures every bit as interesting as I do his successes, because that's what informs our successes.
It has become literally a case of living metamorphosis. Thoughts become things. Choose the good one. We might squeeze in another Mike Dooley thought, but if not, I go with that old classic because it is actually the right. Phil Lillis, I take it you will return next week?
I wouldn't miss it, and I look forward to hearing about the debate.
Well, there we are. Would you like to say bye-bye now?
Bye-bye now.
This is the moment we'll remember.
Once every blue moon, secretly happy kind of feeling, that beaming, floating, purring kind of feeling, that oh-so-rare, please-don't-let-me-be-dreaming kind of feeling, you can feel it right now. Purring the universe.